Writer Colin Fleming joins us. Colin's latest book is Sam Cooke Live, the Harlem Square Club, 1963. But stick around. He's got a new book on Scrooge coming out soon and much more. But right now, Colin here to talk with us about a variety of topics. As always, hello there, Colin.
What is up, Rich Guy Kimball?
Well, you know, doing our thing here on a Tuesday afternoon, trying to make the world a better place with your help.
Yes, well, Kimball is the sea dog. It's all your favorites. Collect and trade them with your friends, right? So, yeah.
My goodness, is it fall, or have you been gifted with this beautiful November weather down in the Boston area?
You know, Kimball, I'm a guy who's so into autumn that part of me is electing to really not recognize October as true autumn. I was thinking about this today as I was running stairs, at least in Boston. I love October, don't get me wrong. But I feel like October is touristy autumn.
So yes.
And you notice, like, the leaves have fallen in the city. But it's really in November. This is key, people, that at least here in Boston, you see the leaves descending. You can try to catch them. I try to get at least one a year. And that, to me, like when it's sort of like getting cold, and a guy like me, I don't have the heat on yet because I tried to save money. I tried to push that as far as I can. And when I'm challenging myself at night and just shivering, that's when I know it's really autumn.
No, I'm with you completely on that. Now, we're doing the same thing, not by choice, but because our boiler died. So, you know, we're huddled up around the family hearth. But we were even talking about the time change, and I'm not a fan of the time change. I would like to pick one and go with it all year. However, I love the fact that it's light earlier in the morning, and I can't say it loudly because people will throw things at me, but I don't mind that as I look out my window at 5, it's pitch black around here.
I don't understand or like this whole thing where mankind says, you know what? Let's just change the time. That makes me, like, wildly... It's like, I won't watch TV with someone, even back when I had a life and I was around people, where they would do that thing where they're like, let's just go back and watch it again. Like, it knocked me out of the space-time continuum, and you know that I'm a man who likes a brisk pace, but I'm someone who respects time and lets time do its thing, and I act accordingly. I don't like when it's, like, light out at all, really. I like when it's dark and gray and all of that stuff. So, but it's pretty balmy today. It was like in the 60s. And don't forget, Christmas barely creeps into winter. Like, it's almost a part of autumn.
Right.
Christmas is like, oh, fall, you're so cool. I'm trying to be a part of you, but I can't quite stretch that far.
But those people who say they like fall, many of them just like late September, which is barely fall, and October. But they don't want any part of November. And to me, I like to embrace the whole package, and that includes the gray of November.
Yeah, November is really a beautiful month with its palette. And I just, and you're still running the stairs, and you sit after you do about 2,000 of them, and you still make a little puddle of sweat on the pavement of Boston. But it's not the lagoon that you get just like a few weeks earlier, but you know you've earned that sweat when it's November, so I definitely like that.
Well, that leads us into our first topic, and it's a wonderful poem by John Clare. We've talked about John before, but oh, how much I love November, and this, well, we're talking about it right now. Thus wears the month along in checkered moods, sunshine and shadows, tempest loud and calms. Boy, that's November right there, especially in New England.
That's some unique radio, because you're right. We have had conversations about John Clare quite a lot. And when you think about that, you probably said this about a lot of things that we discussed. I'm sure there's no one else in the world who's discussing that on the radio, certainly with any frequency. And John Clare, as listeners will know, is a favorite of mine. And this is from a book of his called The Shepherd's Calendar. So it makes sense that we'd eventually get to November. And this poem just resonates and is actuated with so much of the energy of November and these narratives that we find in everything from you just mentioned the sun in this poem, with it being gray outside, an owl decides, hey, you know what? I'll get started a little bit earlier on my feeding rounds. And this jay, she squawks at the owl, like, owl, what are you doing? It's so early, man. You can't be out yet. And when you go outside the next time and you hear the caw of the jay, you think, like, huh, there's probably some commentary on some owl or someone moving before their expected time. And so you have this dislocation in the poem where the world is a little bit off, maybe. Things are happening at earlier times, and then other things are being compensated for at later times. And you have the swirl and the hubbub of life and kids exploring and animals commenting and barnyard critters doing all of these different things and having their own sort of like personal journeys, which are altered within the journey of the seasons, which is what Claire, of course, is trying to bring out.
Yeah, it is a wonderful poem, and it's just, that's perfect. It's the perfect November poem indeed. From there to a wonderful bit of classic radio. Wow, Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce as Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson are such a great team.
They are, and the Nigel Bruce Watson character is more bumbling than actually Watson was in the books and as Watson's portrayed in like the PBS series that a lot of people know from the 80s and into the early 90s. And then the Clive Merrison as Holmes recorded. They did all of the stories and novels. They were the only ones who did that with Merrison.
Did you know that your friend here, Rich Kimball, played Dr. Watson in a regional theater production?
I thought you were going to wow me. Were you going to be like, I was one of only five actors who played both Watson and Holmes upon the stage? Because it's always like a trivia question, right? I think Christopher Lee did it, and so I thought you were going to like insert yourself into that. Like,
no, I played Watson with an actor as Holmes who could never remember his lines. And so The Adventure Every Night for me was not the show. It was, I wonder where he'll take me tonight. What will I have to respond to? It'll be nothing in the script, and that made it exciting.
Watson's quite a perspicacious guy. In all of the other versions, he's not an idiot here with Nigel Bruce, and I like that Nigel Bruce has a bit more responsibility than he usually would, like in the films that he was making with Rathbone at the time, because he sets the scene. He's the intro that the intro probably is pretty humorous now. Is Petri Wines, but this guy hawking Petri Wines, like he comes to Watson's like 221B. But later, it's funny because he's like, I'm at Dr. Watson's ranch house in California. Yeah. like Watson, I picture him like living like some Ponderosa type abode. Like he emigrated, I guess. He went way.
He's got a little beach chair. Life is good.
So this is 1945, and the Rathbone Bruce series, the films we've talked about, like the Scarlet Claw, I think one time, is going to wrap up in 1946, because Rathbone, he wants nothing to do with this role anymore, because he's like, oh, I'm getting typecast and all this stuff. And Rathbone was quite versatile as an actor. People know him in like The Adventures of Robin Hood and from 1939. So he got around quite a bit. And they're tackling the original material in this episode of The Speckled Band, which Conan Doyle rated as, I think he picked, it was 9 of his favorite stories. And they did like a supplementary edition to this. But The Speckled Band was right up there. It's the one about a guy trying to kill his stepdaughter via snake, which is like a tricky sort of way to go about a murder. And you need like a hole in the wall and a flute. it's not an easy thing to pull off. So it's different than a lot of these episodes that you get on the radio with this duo, in that it's drawing on the original source material. So people will know this story, see various adaptations of this story, and it's really awfully faithful. I listened to it again today, and it doesn't really add a lot in terms of like, oh, okay, we have to take this different direction. It's a pretty faithful rendition of one of the stronger stories.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. I also enjoyed a wonderful version of the Great Ambrose Bierce story, Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, from Escape. And it was interesting because my favorite version, other than the story itself, is the Twilight Zone, which was the last episode that ever aired of the Twilight Zone.
Yes, but it also wasn't really the Twilight Zone.
No, it wasn't.
Like they flew it in.
Right.
It's a sort of like, here's a short film from Europe, and we can use this to kind of just end what we've been doing here. But that is how a lot of people were exposed to the story. Certainly, when I was in school, that was something, when the TV was wheeled into the room, that you ended up seeing. And it's one of the great American short stories, certainly for its time period. And it uses a lot of techniques, too, that people weren't using at the time. It has the internal monologue going on, and it's really built with the foundation of the internal monologue. So there's also 50s, I think it is, there's a Vincent Price suspense version. So Suspense did it three times, but I feel like Escape is the radio show of mid-century Americana that's the most literary in some ways, and it's sober. It doesn't try to have a lot of sound effects, like it doesn't have that Wurlitzer organ thing going on as much. It's pretty much a straight-up adaptation of various literary classics. There's a version of F. Scott Fitzgerald's Diamond as Big as the Ritz, which you don't see really adapted that much. But this is very faithful to, again, that idea, to the story. And I think it's the best radio version I've heard of it. I mean, I'd expect it to come from this particular show. And what I like about this is it really draws out how, I mean, it's in the story too, but I just feel like they hammer it home here. It draws out how Peyton Farquhar, who's our guy who's going to be hung, he's with the Confederacy, so he's going to be hung by the Union Army on this railway bridge. He's entrapped. He's just hanging at home in his plantation one night, having mint juleps outside in the lawn with his wife. And this guy rides up, and he's like, hey, can I have some water? I'm like doing my best to fight for our Southern cause and all that stuff. And he's kind to him. His wife goes off, gets the water, and they have this conversation. And the guy who shows up in the scene, he says, well, between you, me, and the lamppost, it'll be invented sometime in the not-too-far future. You can go to the bridge. Yeah, just get around a few people. You blow it up, it'll be cool. It'll really help the cause, man. So Benjamin Farquhar's like, oh, okay. I wouldn't mind like helping the cause. I hate those Union guys. So he goes down, and he gets busted by the same guy. And he's like, oh, I'm actually with the Union. Sorry, dude. I'm going to hack you now. Like, he can't, in the radio version, he can't get over, like, the entrapment aspect.
Right.
He's like, but you just came to my plantation. We hooked you up with that water. You ogled my wife. And so, everyone, if you don't know how the story works, he breaks free when they hang him. He's supposed to be, like, suspended in the air, and his senses sharpen once he hits the water, and he goes off on this, it's not stated explicitly, I don't think, in the radio broadcast, but it's a 30-mile trek home. So he really worked to come to the railroad bridge, and like he puts his hands, he's loosening, it's like, oh, it's a tree root, I'll grab that. It's a water moccasin. It's just very evocative. Those moccasins, cottonmouth, you don't want to have anything to deal with them, and you feel like you're in the swamp with this guy, and, well, spoiler alert, I won't even say it, but it's not going to work out the way it looks like it's going to work out when he finally gets back to the plantation.
No, but in this version, I love the great work that the narrator does in building tension as he's running across the field trying to get home.
There's a great scene where he comes upon like a makeshift abode, and it's one of his former slaves that was like too old, he felt, to contribute to his plantation. He's like, don't turn me in, man. He's like, I'm sorry, like your wife and like your daughter, like he broke apart the guy's home. Like besides the whole thing of like, I own you, human property, and I think, I don't know if people are able to listen to something like this now, it could come to this, and you see how ingrained a way of living becomes in everyone. How really so many people, almost everyone who has ever existed, is a product of their environment. And what they're instructed in as right or wrong is often going to be what they pick up in their own life is the way they're going to go about living their life. It's less of a moral choice sometimes. It's a specific point. Because there are works of art about people from the South, the general, that's probably mm-hmm. the best example, Buster Keaton, where they're not like just demons, but they're also doing this thing that's like obviously sort of like heinous and demonic. I mean, you can't really even apply a label that encapsulates the dehumanization that you're doing to someone else. So he's beholden to this guy not to turn him in within really what's sort of this like stupory, druggy kind of like I'm dying sort of moment, but I don't know I'm actually dying. That's how it's going to work out. And I think that actor who is his former slave that scene just really stands out to me. And this production is something that hits. I think people should listen to that right now and sort of have a discussion about the way these two men interact. I think that would be useful here in 2021. I mean, it's a timeless story.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful production from Escape. You can find it on YouTube. Of an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. All right, so I have this theory, Colin, that ever since I told you however many weeks ago that I'm not always a fan of the live rock and roll, that you just keep tossing things my way to pull me back into the world and embrace it, because you suggested another one this week, and well, it was great stuff. Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks tearing it up in London, Ontario in 1964.
You know what? I've only done that intentionally once, to be candid. I only thought, like, this guy, this MF-er, that's only happened once. That was the time we discussed a Dark Star from Live Last Dead. After your pronouncements about the Leeds 1971 version of Midnight Rambler. But I also wrote a book, obviously about things more than this, but I wrote a book about a live album. And
yes.
So this scrappy fidelity, and I thought you would dig this, though, because it's the group that's going to be the band.
Yeah.
But this is quite a bit different. They're the Hawks at this point because they're playing with Ronnie Hawkins. It's quite a bit different than the band that's going to make like music from Big Pink or the so-called Brown album. This is a sort of, how would you characterize it? It's a biker band,
yeah,
in a way.
And an R&B band as well.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bar band, rhythm and blues band, playing, and this is 1964, and so you have Robbie Robertson, I think he's just one of the best guitarists in rock and roll history. But sometimes he's not talked about that way because people need things to be very overt. They need, like, the long guitar solos and all that stuff. And that's not what the band did a lot of. I mean, there is Bob Dylan called him the most mathematical of guitar players. I think that's accurate. But here, he is just shredding. It's distortion, it's like feedback. In 1964, when you only had kind of like the Beatles accidentally doing it at the very start of I Feel Fine, and it's over loud, it's intense, raucous, it's a prison riot of a set in a bar.
Yeah, and Ronnie Hawkins is just a great leader / master of ceremonies, and I love some of his commentary and trying to get the girls to express themselves, and obviously them loving Levon Helm and the boys, and it's the fun, it's the joy of live rock and roll.
Ronnie Hawkins is because he's, I don't want to say he's like functory, but he's not the talent that they are.
Right.
Yet
right.
There's something when they play together that you can still classify this as exceedingly important rock and roll. Like, it's not lesser, even though he is in some ways lesser. It reminds me almost of Jerry Lee Lewis when he's at the Star Club in 1964, and he'd come over to Europe and England and Germany and all that stuff, and he'd play with whomever he could sort of like get to back him. So he's playing at the Star Club in 64 with a group called the Nashville Team, and the Nashville Teams were fine, but he must have scared the hell out of them, because they played with him that night on one of the greatest rock and roll live albums we have in a way that they never play anywhere else. I mean, I've heard them everywhere else. Like, he dragged that out of them. And I feel like even though Ronnie Hawkins is like the name at the time, the band is helping, the Hawks are helping to drive and pull something from him and from the overall collective. But it's, yeah, it's like sort of like Switchblade rock and roll, like Hell for Leather rock and roll.
And yet very, very tight at the same time.
Oh, they are. The band were one of those American units like the Dead that I think of as the musicianship. I mean, you have groups like the Byrds and the Velvet Underground and the Beach Boys, and they're just some of the greatest American groups of all time. But they got it together in other ways rather than via, like, tightness. Like, if you put the Beach Boys up on stage, or the Byrds in the Battle of the Band, I mean, like, the Byrds would have their moments, especially come 1970. But they couldn't compete with the musicianship of a unit like, I'm mostly Canadian, but of the band or someone like the Dead. So I think that's why Dylan was so jazzed to be playing with the Hawks when he went over to Europe in 1966, and why he also later played with the Dead, like they have that live album from 87. I think because they were musicians who were adroit, not just to playing well together and so accomplished on their instruments, but I think they were skilled at listening to what the others were doing. So you can focus on like a single aspect of the sound, like what one player is doing, and that can hold your attention. And you can also choose to look at what this other player is doing, but it all works within the cohesion of the whole. So it's work and music that really evolves as you evolve. You're able to hear things that maybe you didn't notice before. There's always something to focus on, but not to miss the totality.
And it's a reminder, I think, that the band is often underrated. They were so competent. They didn't always call attention to that musicianship, and a lot of people associate them with the people they collaborated with, mostly Dylan, but others. And I think sometimes, like the Dead, we don't think what gifted, talented musicians they were.
Yes, I think I'm probably going to end up writing at some point in my career multiple books on the Dead. I mean, the Dead, for me, this will sound like shocking, they might be better than the Beatles. They're something, they're like another level of almost all music of any form I've ever heard. And I don't think people pick up on that. I don't think it's articulated well. I don't think it's how their sort of concept and their art, the theoretical concept behind their art and the payoff of their art, I don't think it's how it's discussed and disseminated. So I think there's a pretty big redressing to be done there. The band...
Well, you wrote about it on the blog the other day, and I thought it was very interesting. You were talking about the outtakes from, I think, Rubber Soul, and that it was clear that Lennon and McCartney were being affected by some chemicals, and you listen to Dead outtakes and you hear craftsmanship.
Yeah, I'm actually going to do a standalone post on that, too, where I have 20 minutes of the Beatles working on a song from Rubber Soul, and you get the entire sort of, like, what's going on at the session. And Lennon and McCartney are clearly just fried out of their minds. And if you listen to, like, the outtakes from the Dead in doing Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, these guys are really, like, clear-eyed, sober, focused. Jerry Garcia is cracking the whip. He's the martinet. And I'm not saying, like, oh, this technique is better than this other technique or whatever. But there's a different level of musicianship. Now, that's not the same as, like, okay, I came up with Strawberry Fields Forever one night. But if you look at the Dead, they morphed. They morphed as much as the Beatles. And I don't think anyone knows that. I think people just think they're, like, this jam band. And you know what? That's not even a real thing, a jam band. Because no one talks about John Coltrane and his quartet at the Village Vanguard 60 years ago, November 1961, and calls them a jam band. But they didn't play at the level that the Grateful Dead, I know it's not a Grateful Dead thing, but they didn't play at the level the Dead did when they were at their best, which was an extended prime. And I think that's like a claim that people would be like, oh, did he really just say that? Like, yeah. I think they're better than the Ellington Band. I am deep in them every day. But the band sort of hurt themselves in a way with the whole legacy aspect, because they had but the two sort of top shelf albums, and the rest of their music was notable. But then you have to go looking to Big Pink and the Basement Tape Sessions, right, with Dylan, and On the Road in 66. And these bootlegs, these lo-fi bootlegs, there are several, with Ronnie Hawkins from the era of Beatlemania. But you have to dig. It's not just on the surface other than like those first two records.
Well, check it out. It's great stuff. Ronnie Hawkins and the Hawks, London, Ontario, 1964. Finally, we talk about a work of art from Vasily Polonov that is, it's a beautiful piece. And the story behind it is so powerful. He was basically a landscape artist who then spent 13 years, I guess, trying to put his grief on canvas.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. You would have known him at the time in the late 19th century as like, oh, he's the guy who just paints all those like wonderful like seascapes and open spaces outdoors. And this is not an open space outdoors. He had quite a bit of death in his life. He had a friend of his, a female friend, die, and then another female friend that was like sort of really the love of his life. She died, and he is trying to work from a photograph afterwards of painting, like you said, this work for over a dozen years. Part of the reason he kept painting it for so long was that he couldn't stand to be parted with it, which is like heartbreaking. I have this experience in that like I create so quickly and I come up with these characters or rather they come to me, whatever it is, and I love them and I go into their lives and they let me do that. And it's sad for me because they're like there on a Monday and then I've moved on by like a Tuesday or Wednesday, and it affects me. So I understand, that's why I have to create more. So I understand how he's feeling the way he does. And it's someone lying, a woman lying languidly, almost in bed. And the light in this very dark canvas is tilted in such a way on the little table next to the bed. It reminds me almost like of that famous bit of set dressing in 1931's Dracula that everyone argues about, like the cheap cardboard and everything. Because there was like an attempt when you were sick or dying to have like some sort of light on your face, it seemed at the time, and you have all these sort of items like a note. What does that note say?
Oh yes, little table. Yes.
And the
light that just doesn't quite reach your face.
Yes, and look at the hand, how it's like it's perched between. I've been thinking a lot about hands lately because hands are big. In my book on 1951 Scrooge, like hands are doing all kinds of things. When you see hands, something is afoot. And I referenced this poem that Keats wrote. It was the last thing he wrote. He didn't even get a title. And it is him saying that there's this living hand that's still reaching out to you, meaning my poetry is not going anywhere. It's still alive, even though I am about to depart this mortal coil. And so I think of that hand because it's in this gesture where it's in repose and it's languid, but it's like trying at the wrist to ascend at that joint upwards again, like the way that someone is still living and moving. And to get that sort of observation into this painting, that it's like why Van Gogh loved sunflowers so much, because he suffered as he did, and he saw sunflowers as being alive and also dead in that liminal state between worlds that he wanted to get out of himself, sadly, in either death or naively with his hopes for what his life could be. And you can clearly feel the suffering in this painting of what the observer wants, that physical life of that dying person. This painting is called what it is, but it's often referred to as simply Sick. Yeah. I mean, isn't that just like, talk about like the White Album, Sick. Like, I've never heard of painting called that before. And so like, that's really its nickname. And of course, now in the age that we're in, what people have lost and all that stuff. And then when you just reach a certain age in life, when the deaths start to stack in your own experience, I'll tell you, Kimball, it makes me drink an extra cup of hibiscus tea for my blood pressure.
I would hope so, indeed. Yeah, it's a powerful work. The Patient, Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Oh, do we have a date yet for the Scrooge book?
We do. It is December 1st, and so I don't really know how this works. I know you can get it through Amazon.co.uk so it will definitely get there in time. And I think the American Amazon, like it listed, is like January, which isn't like what I'm going for because it has obviously the Christmas aspect. But right. It's not even really a Christmas book. It's treating this version of A Christmas Carol as the ultimate horror film. And it is a horror film. And it has, I think we talked about this, like my own sort of personal experience as an orphan child in a way and how I connected with this film. But Kimball, you know that I'm not a man prone to hyperbole. It is unlike any film book you will ever read. You'll like it.
I can't wait to read it. Colin Fleming, subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Visit the website colinflemminglit.com. Colin, we'll talk with you again next week.
Okay, sounds good.